Welcome once again to The Buzz. As always, I'm your host, Darian Sumner, and this is BumblingBees.net. Today, for our second episode, we're going to discuss taxation. Seems appropriate for April 15th. Now, nobody write in and tell me that they've moved the deadline. I know that. But it's still April 15th, and so we're still going to talk about taxes. Now, more to the point, we're going to address the question of, is taxation theft? Now, here in the modern world, in the year of our Lord 2017, I see the Libertarian Party on its own Facebook page arguing that churches should no longer be exempt from taxes because that's not fair. What? Is that a libertarian principle to you? Does it seem sensible that we're going to take the tax burden and increase it on people for fairness? Is that what libertarianism is about? According to the Libertarian Party, apparently yes. According to intelligent people, not so much. So first, let's talk about taxation and theft, and let's see if they are the same thing. A lot of people will tell you that taxation definitely isn't theft, but, well, let's look at the words. Merriam-Webster defines theft as the act of stealing, specifically, the felonious taking and removing of personal property with intent to deprive the rightful owner of it. Okay, well, there are only a few avenues I see here for claiming that taxation is not theft. First of all, we could claim that the money taken by the federal government is not personal property, but this seems a little bit strange, doesn't it? If I have money that I have worked for that's sitting in my bank account, that's clearly property. We can get into the definition of property another time, but this clearly qualifies. So the only possibility would be that we're hinging on the word personal. We're claiming that this is somehow some facet of impersonal property, but that doesn't really seem to make any sense. What would that even mean? No, clearly it's personal property. If I take that money and I go purchase something, say I go purchase a shirt with that money, that shirt is clearly my personal property. Therefore, clearly the money spent on that shirt is my personal property, and more to the point, since the federal government reserves to itself the power to tax that money whether I've spent it on a shirt or not, it doesn't really seem that anything has changed vis-a-vis whether or not I have personal property that's being taxed. The other half of the coin is intent to deprive the rightful owner of it. Now, this is important, actually. In legal terms, it is not the crime of theft to take property from someone if you aren't doing so intentionally. If you do so accidentally, like if I don't realize that something is yours, I'm walking through the woods and I see a pretty rock sitting there on the ground and I pick it up and put it in my pocket and I don't realize that I'm in your section of the woods and I've taken a rock that you especially fancy, that's not theft. I am still legally obligated to return it to you upon your presenting proof that it is yours, but I haven't stolen it. Now, are we going to argue that the federal government just doesn't realize that it's taking money that belongs to us? Obviously, that's silly. Of course the federal government realizes this. And at the very least, the fact that the federal government gives us forms that we have to fill out, declaring how much money we've made and how much we've earned, and therefore how much their rates say they deserve, indicates that they know that it is ours, and that they are depriving us of it intentionally. Complicating matters even farther, though in a humorous manner, let's look at the legal definition of theft of services. This comes from U.S. Legal. A person commits the crime of theft of services if he intentionally obtains services known by him to be available only for compensation by deception, threat, false token, or other means to avoid payment for the services. I will leave it as an exercise to the listener to determine if accounting services are generally available only for compensation, and if the federal government wrings those out of us for free under threat. So with that behind us, let's move on to talking about the history of taxation, and in particular, let's talk about taxation in the United States. The United States has a long history of tax resistance. People often like to pretend that tax resistance is some crazy idea that we dangerous anarchists made up like 15 minutes ago, but that simply isn't the case. The nation was founded in tax resistance. The main problem that the colonists had with the British government was taxation. And people sometimes like to pretend that the complaint was that, well, they were being taxed, but they didn't have any seats in Parliament. And some people were irked about that, and some people weren't. But that was sort of a subsidiary point. The key element was that they were unhappy about the taxation itself. They thought that they shouldn't have to pay this taxation since they didn't live in Britain. They didn't have, as we say, representation in Parliament. They weren't part of the empire in that sense. So they didn't think that they should be beholden to all of these taxes. Now, one can argue that that's silly, that they were getting all these, you know, public goods provided for them by the British, and that's fine. But the point is, the Americans were unhappy about the taxation itself. And in fact, many of the key figures in the Revolutionary period were tax resistors. As the historian Charles Adams writes in his brief Tax History of America, John Hancock was probably the leading tax evader in Boston. He was apparently wanted for evading what today would be hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. He was a very successful merchant and importer. His merchant ships arrived almost daily with goods from abroad, and he hadn't paid HMS Customs its full tax for decades. Today, we would call him a tax protester, and he would have a red flag on his tax file. Hancock's bold signature on the Declaration of Independence, we're talking, is a clear reminder that America was founded by tax rebels, and their rebellion eventually gave birth to the United States of America. This is clearly the case. The colonists were upset about a variety of different taxes that the British placed. Particularly, as we all know, it was the Stamp Act that really got the ball rolling, but there were all manner of other acts. The Sugar Act, the Tea Act, the Townsend Act, the charmingly named Intolerable Acts, that were all tax laws of one sort or another. Some of them applied new taxes, some of them applied new collection methods to the existing taxes. But these were what the colonists found outrageous. And so, when they petitioned Parliament for redress, they were always complaining about the tax themselves. Benjamin Franklin was sent about the Sugar Act to complain to Parliament, and his statement was that the colonists objected to the internal tax but would not object to an external tax. Parliament believed that that was pretty ridiculous, which was probably correct, quite frankly. It was a very artificial distinction Franklin was drawing. But for a while, they stuck to mainly external taxes, to what's nowadays generally known as tariffs. But eventually they applied more internal taxes, and as the total tax burden grew, the colonists got more and more upset, and this culminated, of course, in the Revolution. To indicate that this was known to the British, that it was the taxation itself that upset the colonists, I have a speech from Edmund Burke that he delivered on the floor of the House of Commons on the 14th of April in 1774, which obviously was very shortly before the Revolution, in which he stated, in part, "I affirm also that when, departing from the maxims of that repeal," we're talking about the repeal of the Stamp Act, "you revived the scheme of taxation, and thereby filled the minds of the colonists with new jealousy and all sorts of apprehensions, then it was that they quarreled with the old taxes as well as the new. Then it was, and not till then, that they questioned all the parts of your legislative power, and by the battery of such questions have shaken the solid structure of this empire to its deepest foundations." It was the tax itself, and the Parliament's refusal to stop levying new taxes once they had already been challenged on this repeatedly, that set the stage for all of the questioning that the colonists did of the entire British Empire. Everything that the colonists disliked never came up until the taxation became really, really unbearable. And now one could argue that the taxation, by modern standards, was quite light, and that is undoubtedly correct. But the colonists disliked it all the same, and it was the taxation that compelled them toward rebellion. And the taxation, of course, didn't let up when the new country was founded. One of the very, very first events in the Constitutional Republic, we'll set aside the Articles of Confederation, and we'll just focus on the Second Republic, as it were, that was founded with the Constitution, was called the Whiskey Rebellion. Now, the Whiskey Rebellion was very much a tax rebellion. It was nothing else. The Washington administration had levied a tax on whiskey. It was going to be assessed nationwide. It was, well, it was a very Hamiltonian tax. It was definitely designed to benefit the big producers of whiskey at the expense of the little producers, just like we would expect in the modern state. But that wasn't even really the point. It wasn't that they were objecting to the unfairness of some parts of the tax. They were objecting to the existence of the tax altogether. And so most of the people on the frontier, the people who didn't live in the Northeast in the cities, just flatly refused to pay it. And so the Washington administration raised an army, an actual literal army of conscripts. They had a draft, they impressed people into the army, and Washington marched into southern Pennsylvania with a very large army intending to suppress this rebellion. People were apprehended, people were killed, people were dragged to the Capitol through the wilderness in the winter to stand trial. Almost no one was actually convicted of anything. And the Washington administration eventually just abandoned the whole project, because with this huge army, it was almost the size of the army Washington commanded during the Revolution. And with this gigantic army, he couldn't even subdue 4 counties in Pennsylvania, much less the entire remainder of the frontier. So while the government has spun this as a big win and proof that it has taxing authority, in reality what happened was the whiskey tax was just sort of abandoned because it was not collectible. It was repealed very shortly thereafter, and the imposition of a direct tax inside the United States became a dead letter until after the Lincoln administration. There was only one other excise tax, and that was assessed during the War of 1812, and it was also very short-lived. And until then, there was nothing before Lincoln. So let's talk about Lincoln. I don't have very many kind words for Abraham Lincoln, as anyone who's familiar with me will know. I'm not a particular fan of his aggressive war against half of the country, which is often charmingly labeled the Civil War. We needn't quibble about whether or not it was a civil war and what that is. We'll just say civil war from this point to make it simple. Now, Lincoln himself, in his first inaugural address, made it very clear that his primary objection to the seceding states that became the Confederacy was tax-related. We're often told, oh, it was all slavery. Lincoln was just crusading against slavery. He made it quite clear that he did not believe that he had the authority to, nor did he intend to, interfere with the institution of slavery where it existed. On the other hand, here are his own words from his first inaugural address. I shall take care, as the Constitution itself expressly enjoins upon me, that the laws of the Union be faithfully executed in all the states. Doing this I deem to be only a simple duty on my part, and I shall perform it so far as practicable, unless my rightful masters, the American people, shall withhold the requisite means or in some authoritative manner direct the contrary. I trust this will not be regarded as a menace, but only as the declared purpose of the Union that it will be constitutionally defend and maintain itself. In doing this, there needs to be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none unless it be forced upon the national authority. The power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties and imposts, but beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere. You get that? So except for the bloodshed and violence needed to collect the duties and tariffs, there will be no invasion anywhere. Delightful. This does put the lie to the sense that Abraham Lincoln was somehow so enraged by slavery that he just had to crusade against it. Obviously, he was not. He says in his own words, in his own voice, that his war was fought to collect the taxes. That's what he was doing. That's what he was after. He was after duties and imposts. So until the Wilson administration, there was really no way for the government to fight extended wars, because taxation was very direct, and there was no permanent central bank. There were only temporary central banks that were fairly short-lived and were either collapsed or taken down by Andrew Jackson. But once the Wilson administration came along with its Federal Reserve, all of a sudden the federal government had another means of financing its wars. And then later, during the Roosevelt administration, when the great libertarian Milton Friedman invented income tax withholding, it became even more possible for the federal government to take and spend arbitrary amounts of money on senseless foreign crusades. This would not be possible without some means of indirect taxation, because the people would not stand for direct tax rates that high. Nowadays, it's not the case that taxation has just become a dead letter. There are still people resisting, and there are still people being destroyed for resisting. Erwin Schiff comes immediately to mind. If you don't know who Erwin Schiff is, he's passed away at this point. He was a great economist, a great capitalist, a great voice for freedom, who wrote a few books on the subject of taxation, the latter of which was called The Federal Mafia: How the Government Illegally Imposes and Unlawfully Collects Income Taxes. This book is banned in the United States. There are only two books that have ever been banned by the United States federal government, and this is one of them. In this book, Schiff lays out his case for why the federal income tax enacted by the Wilson administration is unlawful. Now, you can agree or disagree with Schiff. That's not the point. The point is, the government thought this idea was sufficiently dangerous that the book itself cannot be sold in the United States to this day. And Schiff was jailed for the rest of his life for writing it. He died in prison just 2 years back, in October of 2015. I'll link on the website to his son Peter's eulogy for him, basically. It's really quite a twisted story, and it indicates the lengths that the federal government will go to keep people from questioning taxation, which is something that we should think about when we see the Libertarian Party, for example, telling us that taxation should be extended so it's even among all people, and when we have people of other libertarian bents, though notably not the Libertarian Party itself, telling us that no, taxation isn't theft, it's just the price we pay for a civilized society, like that creep Oliver Wendell Holmes said. So in short, what we've seen here is that taxation definitely is theft. The only way it could fail to be theft is if the government were just doing it accidentally, which obviously it isn't. That taxation, far from being the price we pay for a civilized society, is effectively the end of civilized society. That the taxation is, in effect, the door that leads from civilized society into barbarism. So let's leave off with one more quotation. This is from John Adams, from his Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States. Adams writes, "Perhaps at first prejudice, habit, shame or fear, principle or religion would restrain the poor from attacking the rich and the idle from usurping on the industrious. But the time would not be long before courage and enterprise would come and pretexts be invented by degrees to countenance the majority in dividing all the property among them, or at least in sharing it equally with its present possessors. Debts would be abolished first, taxes laid heavy on the rich and not at all on the others, and at last a downright equal division of everything be demanded and voted. What would be the consequence of this? The idle, the vicious, the intemperate would rush into the utmost extravagance of debauchery, sell and spend all their share, and then demand a new division of those who purchased from them. The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the law of God, and that there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence. If thou shalt not covet and thou shalt not steal are not commandments of heaven, they must be made into inviolable precepts in every society before it can be civilized or made free. When you're right, you're right." All right, well, thank you for joining us once again for The Buzz, and we'll see you next time.